So
just for lowest level situation, can you describe what a filter is? What is a filter?
Well, a filter is something that takes the time delayed versions of a signal, either in one of various ways, and mixes it with the signal that's coming in the current time, so that you change the frequency response.
And this is.
It's basically combining the signal with the history of the signal. That's what a filter is. It gives you means you have a frequency response and a phase response. And what characterizes a filter completely is as long as it's linear, is its impulse response.
Of course, you could just change the phase and leave the frequency response the same.
Well, yes, that's very easy to do, actually.
So, again, at the very bottom line, like, for instance, a low-pass filter is something that allows up to a certain frequency range to pass.
And then
it
starts to roll off. So you define, for a low-pass filter, you define four points. The bottom, which is DC for all the stuff we do. The point at which it starts to roll off, the point at which it finishes to roll off, and then, of course, whatever the sampling rate is. So you define four points. And typically, if you're using any of the filter design programs, they're all, that is 0 to 1, where 0 is DC and 1 is half the sampling rate. So say if you're trying to design something that's cutting off, taking out roughly half the signal, you might say you put in 0 to 0.45 to 0.55 is the end of the cutoff to 1, and that will get you something which rolls off through half of the sampling rate.
And that cutoff is a slope, right?
It depends. If you're talking about IARs, it's a slope in terms of dB per octave. If you're talking about analog IARs, it's dB per octave. If you're talking about digital IARs, it's not dB per octave, it's dB per linear scale. Remember, digital works on a linear scale, analog works on a log scale, so they're fundamentally different in that way, which is why a Butterworth does not look like a Butterworth if you do a digital Butterworth.
And the other thing that I understood is that the sharper that the slope is, the more ripple there is in the bandpass. Is that correct?
Well, it depends. If you make the filter longer, you can get rid of the ripple in the bandpass.
Okay.
But if you try to make the filter the same length, talking at an FIR now, if you try and make it the same length, but you try and make it steeper, then you get more ripple.
Okay.
And that's actually one of the things people do to try to use shorter filters, which creates pre-echo. So, like I was about to show in about 2 minutes, don't do that. But
and shorter filters allows less processing requirement.
The shorter the filter. Every tap in a filter requires a multiply and an add. So if you make a shorter filter, you have few multiplies for your adds. Yeah?
You mentioned that filtering from 0.45 to 0.55 isn't that technically insufficient because you have energy above half the rate?
Well, I'm just talking about making a low-pass filter. I'm not talking about making an anti-alias filter.
Okay, sorry.
An anti-alias filter, it depends. If your bandwidth is 0.45, that would work.
Okay.
But it would work because you have 0.45 to 1 minus 0.45. And this is the kind of thinking you're going to get into in a minute. And when you do more than two or when you do multi-stage, it can make your head hurt. And I'm not going to give you a test. And I'm going to put the thing out there. And I can also point, anybody that wants to know how to do this stuff for real should get an old book that's out of print by Crozier and Urbiner called Multi-Rate Signal Processing. And it tells you exactly how to do this. No muss, no fuss. It just said it was written in early 1970s, and it tells you exactly how to do it. So it's a solved problem. If you want to know how to do fractional interpolation and stuff, then you get a hold of, there's a book by a guy named Proakis that'll tell you how to do stuff so that you don't have to have a fixed sampling rate. If you know when the time instances when things come in, you can calculate the right filter. Or if you have variable time going out, you can calculate the right filters. So you can do that too. I mean, it's one of these things you could, if you had a clock that was good enough, you could use it to take out jitter, but good luck with that terahertz clock. So basically, in most cases, you use a symmetric FIR filter. This means that about the center of the filter, the two taps on either side are identical. Now, a symmetric filter is constant delay. That's why you do this. An anti-symmetric filter, by the way, is also constant delay. But you cannot actually have DC with an anti-symmetric even order filter. If you think about it, plus one, minus one is going to disappear your DC. Now, you can do it with an odd order filter, but you can't do it with an even order filter. You have a symmetric thing. It means that the result of the filter, if you plot the phase shift of the filter, if you basically take a transform of the filter taps, you'll see something where the delay is equal to 2 pi ft. That called linear phase, which is exactly the same as constant delay. It has lots of energy before the center of the before the center of the filter, which can be a problem if you design it the wrong way. You can get pre-echo.
So the t in this case would be constant.
The t in this case would be constant. It's the time delay. Yes,
and if it goes into it goes out of time.
Yes, right. And interestingly, if you don't make the filter too short, you won't get into these pre-echo. So it means if you make the filter longer, you actually get less pre-echo. That sounds weird, but that's how it works. And this kind of filter is used almost everywhere. Almost. There are classic IR filters, typically minimum phase filters, because you like to actually have them be stable. Although you can have non-minimum phase pole zeros. It's like if you have an elliptic filter, in fact, they have non-minimum phase zeros. But it takes much more mantissa length. That's the first problem. It also takes much more mantissa length. And I mentioned it takes a lot more mantissa length.
Can you define that, please?
Mantissa, meaning the number of bits you have in the floating point number that describes the actual value, not the exponent. And the reason for that is that IR filters use a different method. Instead of having long, you can do a sixth-order IR filter that rolls off like a 200-tap FIR filter. That's the good news. The bad news is it means that all that information is stored in six variables. And you're storing the same amount of information in six variables that you were storing in 200 variables. As a result, you have to have more resolution. And it's not an easy thing to calculate. People have been beating on this until they all gave up using IR filters, basically, for the most part. But what it amounts to is you have to go to double, triple, quadruple precision. I mean, for instance, if you wanted to do a 20 hertz high-pass filter at 96 kilohertz, you have to do double precision input to get 14 bits out. And that's just how it is. And that means double precision IEEE. So you need 56-bit mantissa to get 14 bits out. So that's the big gotcha with IARs, is you need longer word length. And they will have, the sharper they get, the sharper a minimum phase filter gets, the more phase shift it has around things. That means the delay is not 2 pi ft, means the delay, means the, if you will, the phase shift is zero up to half, and then the phase shift goes woohoo when you go through the transition band. And then if you have something that has zeros in it, like a Chebyshev 2 or an elliptic, that means then the filter goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, but that's only in the stop band. So if you're down 130 dB, you probably don't care about that, you know? It really doesn't matter what you do when the signal's no longer there.
I was going to mention that, to give a point of reference.
Yeah.
32-bit float has a 25-bit mantissa.
Something
like logic that's if it's doing just 32-bit processing, only got 25-bit mantissa.
Yes. Nice thing is that gets floated over the level of your signal. The problem when you're doing something like an IR too is because it stores information and you're taking differences of large numbers, you lose a lot of
resolution.
Resolution, yes, or the lack thereof. So people do this. It has been done if you're doing speech processing, and you don't need really steep filters at low sampling rates.
Why would you use an IIR filter?
Say if you're doing a filter, a D-channel bank filter that's 300 to 3200 hertz and an 8 kilohertz sampling rate.
But why wouldn't you just do an FIR?
Because
what's the advantage?
the advantage of using the IIR is it maybe uses 1/10 of the CPU.
Okay.
Now you might only get 8 bits out, but you know, for speech you're okay.
I think there's a bunch of DACs that use minimum phase IIR filters, and the reason they're trying to minimize that latency for use in sound reinforcement applications.
Yeah, the problem is that there's a way to do that, and for everything but the final you actually do an FIR for the first upsampling filter, and you can use IIR for the rest of them because it doesn't matter. For the rest of them, it can have a nice long transition band. You can do that. And there are these things called appetizing filters. I'm not part of that particular proprietary function, but what it amounts to is you can take an FIR filter that's symmetric and factor out the zeros, and take the zeros that are outside the unit circle and put them inside the unit circle. You get the same frequency response, but you get a different phase shift. So you can trade off between minimum phase and linear phase. And there are claims that these sound better. I'm not entirely convinced. You can also add a few poles into that mix, and some people have done that. I'm not entirely convinced of this. It seems like an awful lot of work for very little gain, but I'm not going to argue with people's product literature, you know?
At what point does this become perceptible?
Well, that is a good question.
It might be a buzzword.
Some people claim that it's perceptible immediately, but they can't seem to get it in a double-blind test.
Well, might as well guess then.
Other people insist it can't possibly be audible, and you can never get pre-echo out of an FIR filter, and then all you have to do is take some of the older resamplers and play them and prove that there's the audible pre-echo. Merry Christmas. So the answer is it's somewhere in the middle. You can do it wrong. But the moral of the story is you can do it wrong either way, to tell you the truth. That really is the moral of the story.
Looks like it started out in optical.
Yeah. Filter. Yeah. Then there's half-band filters. If you really trust your input signal, you can use a half-band filter. But you really have to trust your signal. And if you can't, you shouldn't use a half-band filter.
Trust the signal to be band-limited?
Band-limited, so there's no energy at FS over 2. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that, please don't use a half-band filter. You just heard a lot of A to D and D to A designers screaming at me. Tough. You can measure the results. Sometimes you can hear the results. I don't care.
Can you define half-band filter, please?
A half-band filter is a filter which is down exactly 6 dB at FS over 2. And when you design a filter, it's the same sort of symmetry thing. If you design a filter, its response is exactly symmetric over FS over 2, that means every other tap is zero. That's why people use half-band filters. It takes half as much processing. So if you trust your signal, that's great. Big if. And, yeah?
We're getting so much more processing every year. Aren't some of these becoming completely moot points?
I think so. You can, but you understand if you can get another 0.3 cents out of that chip. Yeah, I know. Yes, you're not the first person to roll your eyes there.
Or if you can do twice as many channels.
Oh yeah.
Whatever you have right now.
Yeah, that's the kind of problem.
16 A to Ds and 3D to As and one little chip for 49 cents.
Yeah.
We can do it.
Yeah, you can do it.
We just take
so. Let's not talk about quality, but you can do it.
Yeah. I was going to ask that
too.
And by the way, when you're doing downsampling, half-band filters will bite you firmly on the butt.
I was going to ask about your concept of trusting that the original signal has no energy at Nyquist.
Yeah.
Can you define every filter though? It doesn't ever reach negative infinity. It's basically a certain number of dB per octave.
No. That's analog filters.
Yeah. Okay.
Digital filters, actually, and some analog filters can have zeros.
Okay.
They can have points at which the output is zero. But for this, if you're below the LSB, you know, you want to be below the LSB.
I was going to say, so for a given bit depth, is there a way to define how low your filter has to be at the lowest to say that it's good enough?
Half an LSB, half a least significant bit. That would make me happy. Especially since most 24-bit systems are between 18 and 21. I mean, you see all these 24-bit systems, most of them are, well, most of them are under 20. A few of them make it to 22. But if you think about what it takes to make a 24-bit system, that means you have to have 2 to the 48th electrons per second. Figure out that current. Now we're talking about milliamps.
Well, there's a much bigger problem than that.
Yeah.
There's stability.
Well, yeah.
And sensitivity and specificity, the minute you start going below 20 bits.
Yeah.
And what makes a true 24-bit board extremely expensive,
like
$100,000 a board, is the fact that all of that has to be very carefully mapped, temperature, frequency,
line, the whole nine. The nice thing, at least about using single-bit converters, is you don't have two-thirds of those problems. You have a crap load of signal processing, but that's deterministic. But you still run into the problem that, you know, the charge of the electron is quite finite.
Well, the other problem is consider the in-situ use of measuring the unit under test.
Oh, yeah.
And all the paraphernalia going from where the signal is generated to where it's resampled and finally comes out as digital data.
Yep, yep.
You have to look at that entire
system
because you're not going to get the 20 bits out of that.
Well, you might get the 20 bits
out
of...
You might get 20, but you won't get...
You might get... Bits. Well, if you get 25 out of the detector, you might get 24 out of the whole thing if you do it right.
It would take a lot of work.
Yes, well...
And you'd have to run it in an echoic chamber that has...
Well, no, that's a different... Where are you going to get the microphone? That's a different problem.
The problem is, you know, down the street here is physio control.
Yeah.
And we first started building cardiac pacemakers that were self-pacing.
Yeah.
We had to sample those down to 22 bits. It took $2.5 million in 2 years to build a system that could adequately test that and be repeatable enough so the FDA would approve it as a standard.
So it's it's a hard process. It is a really hard problem.
Then the question becomes, at what point does it become economically practical to do anything much more than 18?
Well,
because you can't hear it.
Well, that's if I can hear it. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing: the noise level at your ear, in terms of broadband 20 to 20K, is about plus 60 BSPL white noise. So getting below that is a little bit odd. I mean, as long as it's white noise, because, you know, you can't hear that because your ear separates it into you know, filters it, so you can't quite hear that. Interestingly, that noise level is about a dB below the absolute threshold of hearing for a person with normal hearing. It's interesting how that works out. You can't quite hear the noise level of the atmosphere. So the point is, getting below that is sort of ridiculous. But if you go from 6 dB and you do 24 bits, you get from 6 dB to 150 dB. How many people want to sit in 150 dB? How many people have a system that will make 150 dB? We're done here.
Not after you do that for a little bit.
What?
Let's see, Boeing up the street has several systems.
That
about 163 or so.
Yeah, but
so they're a little tough in the ears.
Yes, they are. Well, the other thing about these, about this, you know, now you saw some people talking about wanting to go to 32-bit audio. I mean, that goes from the noise level of the atmosphere to a, was it 1.4 atmosphere overpressure. Mm-hmm. What do you think, you know?
That's an atomic bomb.
Yeah. Well, yeah, basically, the only way you get a transducer for that
is a disposable one.
Is a disposable one, you know. I like that. I like that. A disposable one. Yeah. So, practical system for a 2x up sampler. I'm going to actually show you how to do a 2x up sampler here. You notice every other sample is zero. Now,
can I break in again?
No, but go ahead.
We're using the word zero. I'm getting a little bit confused because you're talking about zeros sometimes as poles and zeros, I think.
Well,
and then you're also using the term zero as in no number.
Well, when I use a term in terms of poles and zeros, it's referring to the root of an equation. And you really don't want to you don't want me to go into that math.
Okay, good.
And when I say insert zeros between every other sample, I mean you put the value zero.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay.
To make it twice as low.
Yes. Now, this is a nice, the nice thing about when you do this, when you're upsampler and you put in zeros when you have a sample, you notice that half, you know that half the inputs are zero. So that means if you have a big long filter, first you use the odd parts of the filter and then you use the even parts of the filter. Then you step the data by one, use the odd parts of the filter and even parts of the filter. So at your final sample rate, the filter is effectively only half as long. Follow that? I see Bob's processor running.
Go ahead.
Okay, but that's the point is that you can do this very easily. You only have to do half of the filter for each output if you're upsampling by two. This is very convenient, and this is also how you do it. And of course, you have to multiply either the input or the output by two, like we said before, but typically you just you build that into the filter coefficients. So we've seen the results. What do we observe? Well, you have to remove the signal images, right? You have to do the property. You can screw up by making bad filters. You can use half-band filters when you shouldn't. You fill with zeros to avoid doing other frequency shaping. Those ones where we copied the data, I would have to put in a separate filter to correct for the sine x over x error. And that's not a simple filter, and it's not something that's easy to design because it rises and then drops. And that's sort of not what you usually try to design in a filter. So you use the zeros, and you have to gain normalize. But, you know, we all know how to do that. Right?
No.
All the time.
Okay. Downsampling by two. How do you downsample? Well, you throw out every other sample. What do you think happens, though? You heard, what did that downsampled by four thing sound like? I noticed some people in the back were quite properly sitting there like this. I understand. So the point is, what do you do? Well, you have to filter below half of the new sampling frequency before you throw out every other sample. That's the whole key. Before, got it? Before. Mm-hmm. Now, this is convenient also because you only have to figure out what every other sample is. So again, you get this advantage in filter length because you only run the filter. You run the filter, move two samples, run the filter, move two samples, run the filter. But you have to use the right filter. So this is how you do downsampling. Now, when you're doing single-stage upsampling, single-stage downsampling, the two filters are identical, assuming that you're using the same frequency, the same two rates, the filter is identical. Just one time you go up, use half of it, the other half of it, the other half you go down. When you're going down, you don't have to use your factor of two because you're not throwing anything away. When you're going up, you're throwing away half of the energy twice, so you have to multiply by two.
Now, this may be a obvious answer, but with an infinite impulse response, you probably can't take advantage of throwing away every other sample, but with the finite impulse response,
with the infinite impulse response, you have to run it at the high rate and then throw away every other sample. Obviously, if you try to run it, I don't even want to think about that. Okay, you realize that's going to alias the filter coefficients. Can you figure out what that means? I probably figured this out once 30 years ago and decided not to do it. You know what I mean? I don't even want to think about it too hard, do you?
It's going to sound really weird.
Only talking single level.
Yeah.
Filters, you're not talking about things that where you actually have eight filtering systems of tau delayed.
Yeah.
And then they're recombined digitally.
No, we don't even want to think about that.
And then alias.
So the point in going up and down for sync when you're doing it all in one step is pretty much identical. So that's how you do 2-to-1. Do 3-to-1 and 4-to-1 the same way. That's pretty much the best way to do it.
Are these similar to visual interpolation on video screens?
No. Visual interpolation does not have to have anti-aliasing. Visual interpolation has to retain edges and not put in judder and things like that. Mm-hmm. Sorry, not judder, but not put in breaks and lines and stuff. That's important for a video filter. For audio, you have to maintain the frequency domain. So you have completely different filter requirements. Video, you want to avoid adding visual artifacts or turn the spatial domain. Audio, you want to avoid, you don't care as much about the time domain, you have to avoid the frequency domain artifacts. So, you know, there, this is, well, I think I gave the talk here, audio versus video, about 10 years ago. Is it time to do that again? Probably. Because they're very different. And the reason they're very different is because the eye and the ear work very differently. Interesting, they have about the same dynamic range, but that's about as far as you can get.
Question.
Yeah.
So, at the beginning of this slide, you said that you filter before you drop the samples.
Yes. But when you're using... Yeah.
If you're... If every other filter or if every other tap is zero.
No, every other tap is not zero here.
Oh, you're
this is for downsampling.
Okay.
So all the taps are full when you're downsampling.
Okay.
But so you have to apply the whole filter, but you only have to get an output every other sample. So if you're an FIR filter, you only have to use the filter every other sample. So you calculate the whole length of the filter, but you only do it half as many times.
And that's because you know you're going to throw those away.
Because if you're going to multiply them by zero and then throw them away, you might as well not calculate them, which is what you do.
And the FIR doesn't have feedback, so you don't have to have the previous answer to.
Precisely, there's no time. There's no the storage is it to where the storage in a filter is built right into the impulse response. There's no storage inside of a variable from sample to sample.
So basically, doing it at the before you. But before you basically downsample,
yeah.
Calculating the filter, what was it?
When you do that, you remove all the stuff above half of the new sampling rate by doing a low-pass filter. Mm-hmm. So now what you have is you have stuff, so there's nothing below half of the new sampling rate.
Nothing
and then,
above.
What?
Nothing
no,
above.
No energy. No, nothing above half
above,
of the new.
Yeah, above, below.
Nothing above half of the new sampling rate. So then when you throw away every other sample, you have these two things like this. They go like this, not like this. Okay?
And that last thing was aliasing.
That last thing is aliasing. That last thing is ouch. Okay?
It's fairly easy.
Now, somewhat obvious if you use a half-band filter there, whatever is at half of the new frequency is just going to stay there forever. And don't do that, okay? So now doing 8-to-1. Well, it sounds like you can do, sure, you can design a filter easily to do 8-to-1, but that's not really the way to do it. Because if you think about what those spectra look like after you do, say, a 2-to-1 oversample, and I should have made a better picture of this maybe, but after you do a 2-to-1 oversample, you have a signal here, you have a signal here, and you have this big space in the middle so you can have a filter that rolls off very slowly. So you do upsample by 2, and you get a big space for the filter to roll off. And then you design a second filter with that roll off, which is much, much shorter. And to show you what happens, if we do the original thing, 100 dB stop band, you get a 2000, and do it, and you do it directly, you get a 2000 tap filter, divide that by 8, that gives you 250 multiply adds per sample, because you can do the same thing, you get only use 1/8 of the filter each time. So you get 250 operations per sample. That's not that bad, but let's do something here. Let's do an upsample by 2. You still have to put in that filter, but now you notice you have all of this space for the transition band. This is what happens when you upsample by 2. You get this big hole in the middle. So you can generate your second filter. It doesn't have to roll off between here and here. It rolls off between here and here. So you get a shorter filter. So what happens? This is a key, and this works both for down and up, but for this you can't use the same filter for down and up. You always have to lead with the steep filter. So if you're downsampling, you do the first filter is steep. If you're doing upsampling, the first filter is steep, because that's what gets you the space to work with. And so what happens? Now we need, well, where does it? So the first filter is 488, but it's 488 running a quarter of the output rate. So it's running, you know, you get a fair number of taps. And the second filter now is only 92 long. So you have 488 divided by 8 plus 92 over 4. So you have, instead of 250, you have 84. Now you have to over-design these filters by 3 dB because you're going to run two filters in parallel. But still, this beats doing 250. So this is how you do things above 4. And typically, you do either 2 or 4 for the first one, and then you do by 4, by 4, by 4, by 4. Seems to be about the right way. That book I was talking about by Crozier and Rabiner has tables that tell you how to do it up to some. They figured out the optimum thing, but if you do by 2, and either by 2 or 4, and then by 4, by 4, by 4, by 4, you'll get the right, you'll get a good result. And one of the things you find after the second stage, you find out you can wind up with like an 8-tap filter, which is handy. So that's how you do this. Okay, downsampling stages the same way, but you have to do this. Remember, you have to use the tight filter at the beginning. Well, so it's somewhat complicated, but you can do up and down sampling of ratios. Suppose after we did upsample by 8, but we only calculated every third output. So now you've done an upsample by 8/3. Because you know it's still limited. Until you get down below that original sampling rate, you're not going to get any aliasing. You filtered it all out, right? So now you can do 8/3. Or 8/5 or 8/7 or whatever. And the point is, you can also do 8/6 and 8/4 or 8/2, but it's much easier to do that by just doing upsampling by 4 instead of 8, or upsampling by 2 instead of 8, you know. If you do 8/4, that's the same as doing 2:1. So there's no point in doing something like that, but you can. This shows how to get, now this gets you any ratio of integer to integer. So that gives us the one that everybody's always twitching about, the 48 to 44.1, right? And that's not the way to do it. But the point is, for any fractional rate, as long as the output rate is higher than the input rate if you're upsampling, you can take any periodic signal out of that and get a valid sampling rate with a valid spectrum, and which is handy. There's a equivalent to this for downsampling, but basically it's the same thing. You can put in the 3, upsample by 3, and downsample by 8. But filters are different, but I think you can, once you just build the way to do this is to draw the spectrum at every stage, and then it will become suddenly obvious. And there's no general rule. You just have to do your homework. So, yeah, you can do it directly. Yeah, you'd need, I don't know how long the filter is, because working in double precision, I can't calculate the filter. And if you can't calculate it in double precision, you don't want to implement it in double precision. So I don't know what it would be, but it would be a very long filter, and I didn't get the multiple, you know, I don't have the pack that gets me beyond double precision in MATLAB, and that's okay, because you shouldn't do this.
So what do they define double precision in MATLAB?
It's 56.8. It's IEEE.
So it isn't using the 128 or 256-bit mantises?
No, but you probably do this in 512, I think. But if you think about what you're doing, you're designing a low-pass filter that rolls off at 1, you know, 1 over 44, 1 of the thing. You know, that's a pretty steep filter. And you want to have under a 1/110 of a dB in-band ripple and over 120 dB stop-band ripple. So that's a pretty long filter. I mean, you can use Fourier mathematics to tell you what it is. And, you know, that would, you know, just if you just use the windowed sync filter, it'd be like 512K or something horrific, you know. You don't do it that way. Yeah. So that's not what you do. So what you do, you say you upsample by, say, 32. So now we know that all the spectrum is in the bottom 32nd of the band, right?
Can you go back one, please?
I will.
Okay. instead of using the LCM.
Least common multiple.
Thank you.
Okay. So what do you do? But now you have something. What do you do now? Now what you do is you interpolate between the samples at the higher rate with a second filter. The requirements of the second filter is it has to be flat over the bottom 32nd of the spectrum. And that's all it has to do, and then it has to roll off. But since you're adding more than two samples together, it's kind of likely it's going to roll off. So that is how you do it. Use a short filter, and you calculate a short filter via formula, either windowed sync. You can use Chebyshev. You can use Prony sequences. You can use, what do they call them? There's a discrete form of, I'm forgetting it. There's a bunch of ways to do this. You have to be careful, but what that means is you can use a formula now that gets any point between those 32 samples. So now you can calculate any rate. And that's how you do it. And that's how a lot of people do it. There is other ways to do this. This can create error. I mean, if you think about it, if you have something where the high frequency side of it's going like this a little bit, you're going to have a problem and you're going to be modulating it at something related to the sampling rate, which is seriously uncool. Which, by the way, is I think what NCH is doing. So you can get into problems this way. You have to be careful. There are other ways to do this. Well, what it gets is you can get an arbitrary point. Now, see, this way, if I decide that instead of, you know, outputting it from going from 44.1 to 48, I want to go to 44.8, but I know that the samples aren't going to be quite evenly spaced, I can still calculate the right value for those non-evenly spaced samples. There's this whole thing called stochastic sampling, and you can do all sorts of wonderful stuff this way. But it's a lot of work, and you have to calculate things. And, you know, you can figure this out. You just figure out the phases. Now, you can also build something that interpolates to that rate in stages instead of a direct filter. So you can build and then convolve it all together, and you can get a big, long filter. And then you can put things in at one set of taps and take them out at the other set of taps, and this also works. This gives you a nasty integer mathematics problem, but you can get the result that way. So you can build the whole impulse response by using a bunch of shorter filters and convolving them together with the right upsampling. You can do this as well. This is actually a way that's absolutely safe. You can do fractional rates, but you have to know the fractions. That's for a fixed rate. You can't do a variable resampling that way. And this is absolutely stone cold safe. You just have to solve the problem, if you will, of the interference pattern between the two sets of input and output samples. And this is what some of the better ones do. It's a fixed rate. You can't do any of the approximations. So if you have something, one of these things has to join up two systems that don't have a common clock, this won't work. But the way you do those systems that join two systems that don't have a common clock is the first way that I described, because that way you can just sort it out. If you need a half sample shift and so on, you can get partial sample shift. You can get any amount of sample shift. If, say, you're trying to do very much subsample shift, this is the way to do it. Okay, like I said, another way, by using the stages, you can build the impulse response. Avoids a lot of the word length issues. It can't be optimum, though, because you can't jointly design all of the filters. But still, you can do pretty well. You know, it's not like it's catastrophically awful. And then what you do is you calculate all of the phases, and then you figure out which phase you need to use at each one, and it all works. And I notice it looks like your head hurts when you're trying to figure out how to figure out which phase. It does. It's not simple. See, so you use this direct conversion. It's a mega filter, but you break it down to pretty whole bunch of really short filters. So this can work too. This avoids the problems with the interpolation process, which can blow up on you if you use the wrong, if you do the wrong thing. And there's even another way you can design a windowed sine x over x filter. That means you'll have to calculate the values of sine x over x for every sample. Again, this won't go wrong. The Windows resampler, when it's turned up to high quality, does this. Sucks up lots of CPU, but it will get the right answer. So there's a lot of ways to do these. This one also can do arbitrary sample locations. But make sure you use the right window selection. Don't use an elliptic window. Don't use a Chebyshev window. Please use something like a hand window. Okay. When you do it the right way, it's not really hard. The whole key is to figure out where that passband is, filter everything to the passband, and then handle it appropriately. That's really what it comes down to. But it depends on the choice of the filters. I'm being sarcastic. I said it happened once or twice. That is a little bit sarcastic. Too much in-band ripple, making filters too short. You can get pre-echo a couple of different ways. People think symmetric. Some people think all symmetric FIR filters create pre-echo, but they can't prove it yet in a blind test. I'm not necessarily saying it's wrong. If you make it steep enough, certainly you can. But nobody, I think nobody's crazy enough to make it, you know, rolling off in 2 hertz, but you know, the last 2 hertz. That's a little bit crazy. Yeah?
So is the point here that a symmetric FIR filter, say perfectly implemented, all the pre-impulse filters would cancel out, thus no pre-echo, but if you truncate that, then now you don't get a perfect cancellation, is that?
No, what happens is when you design the optimum filter, if you design a shorter optimum filter, you will have more in-band ripple, and the in-band ripple is equivalent to having points to both ends of the filter.
I see. Okay.
I have a question. This might be a little off topic, but pre-echo, yeah. Is there a generalized like threshold of what people consider you can hear and can't hear?
There's a lot of argument about it. Anything that comes more than about 0.8 of a millisecond before is going to be a, you know, any amount of energy that's detectable more than about 0.8 of a millisecond before is going to cause a problem because it starts your ear compressing. Okay. So that's going to decrease the loudness of the actual attack.
Okay.
There are many arguments about this. There's a lot of arguments about how it messes up imaging. Most of these are in long block coders, but one of the problems with long block coders is that the pre-echo comes, is mirrored, so if you have attack toward the middle of the block, the pre-echo comes toward the beginning of the block. So what happens is if you have signal that actually has some kind of time cues in it, it reverses the time cues for the pre-echo. And that will screw up imaging. Oh, you betcha. So, you know, there's not a simple answer to your question, unfortunately. Except that comfortable in saying pre-echo bad. That's a safe statement. So a little bit about filter design. FIR, this is how to do it. You can load up Octave yourself and play with it. It's free. It more or less works most of the time.
Remez exchange algorithm in MATLAB too.
Well, no, Remez has been replaced by FERPM.
Uh-huh.
But it's still using Remez.
10 years.
Oh, it's using modified Remez. You know, there's been some improvements to Remez. And for instance, by the way, the Remez exchange algorithm and Rabiner and Gold actually has a bug in it.
Rabiner, that's the guys that did that book, right?
Yeah. Okay. There's actually a bug in their Remez. It's not very bad, but there is a bug.
Oh, in the code, not the algorithm.
In the code, not in the algorithm. And it also has to do with this regularity theorem thing. So design two filters. I'm going to design one that has a passband ripple at 100 dB and two equal ripple, and filter two equal ripple and passband and stopband 100 dB down, which means that there really is no passband ripple to speak of. I mean, it's down, you know, plus or minus 10 to the minus 5, which is not much of a dB. So those are the two filters. They're both working at a sampling rate of 2. This is doing a 2 to 1 interpolation or decimation filter. And so this is how you would call either one of them. Weight, you have to play with the weight on that one to get it to come out. The other one, you can leave out the weight if you want equal weight for both. So that's how you would design these filters in the software. I can talk more about this later if you want. Okay, so what happens? There's filter 1 and there's filter 2 over here. If you take a look here, well, this is filter 1. You notice that's the pass band. That's the stop band. You notice there's those bumps on the end. That's where your pre-echo comes from. Now, filter 2, notice that's 200-tap filter. Okay, now this is a 500-tap filter, but if you look at 200, now if you look, that's your passband ripple now. Notice, 2 times 10 to the minus 4 dB. That's not a lot of ripple, is it? And you notice there's no lump at the end of that. And that's why. In fact, if you actually blow up the end of it, there's still a little bit of lump at the end of it that corresponds to that passband ripple at 2 times 10 to the minus 4 dB. But you notice that's down 100 dB, which is the whole point, of course. And the filter is quite steep, which is what you would expect. So now what happens if we put the two impulse responses over each other? You see the difference there. The shorter filter is bigger at 200 samples than the longer filter. And therein is why you don't use a filter that's too short, because your ear will detect that first part of the signal. And now the way that what happens, the first part is canceled by the phase of the second side, but your ear is a minimum phase system. If it detects it before the peak hits, it detected it. Have a nice day. You heard it. It's detected, you heard it. It doesn't matter that the Fourier transformer disappears because your ear already detected. Your ear isn't linear. So there you go. That's where you run into trouble. And I don't remember the brand anymore, but the first one we bought for 44.1 to 48 for doing the DAR project back when I was at Bell Labs. Yeah, it had the crunchiest pre-echo you ever did hear.
So, is this time domain?
Yeah, that's time domain.
As compared to the frequency domain, which is what we saw before. Now, when we say time, is this actually time going from start to end? Is this actually across?
This is the impulse response of the filter.
Okay. Could you explain it a little bit?
Well, you have two filters here. This is actually the value. If you look at the value at each point, this tells you the tap weight of the filter. So if you look here, you notice this is about how much bigger? That's the point. That's very audible. It just has too much.
But this has nothing to do with, like, time, literally seconds, not like a
that's samples. That is samples. That is samples.
So it's 0 to 500 samples.
Yes.
Each
individual sample goes in as an impulse and comes out like that. So yeah. It gets smeared.
Yeah.
So you have to open
this, if you will, is the smearing function.
If you put in a single sample, this is what you get out.
Okay. And I see that they're not in, if you can call it phased, right? Is the left-hand side to the right-hand side, is that just a blurring here, or is that actually information we're seeing?
Which?
The coefficients.
Oh. Yeah, see how the left-hand side of the thing is not aligned, and then right after the big bump?
It looks like I plotted it off by one sample, but no, they shouldn't overlap anyhow, because they're different filters. They shouldn't overlap anyhow.
Okay.
But in fact, it looks like I'm off by one sample in the center of one filter. Sorry about that.
Okay, so that's not information we need to grab. So I just want to boil it down to what we're actually trying to.
What you're trying to see is that big bump.
Is the bumps the red?
The bump.
It should be smooth all the way out.
Yes.
And just big in the middle.
Yeah.
Smooth all the way out. If it's big in the outside, then we hear.
Then you might hear a pre-echo.
Okay.
Depending on how big it is.
There's a separation in time between that little bump and then the big.
Over 2 milliseconds before the main event.
Look at the previous slide.
The main event.
Previous slide?
Yeah, just
because that generated the it's the comparison between 1 and 2, right? So that's
it's comparison between that.
This is what I wanted to see. Yeah. Anyway, that's a low pass filter.
Yeah.
That's how you do it.
That's a low pass filter, and that's a low pass filter.
And that's going from 488, 200 to 488. Okay.
Yeah. And those are the differences in the plot and the time domain. And this can get you into trouble because the year isn't even remotely linear.
Sure is weird. You can look at these responses, impulse responses, and yet it doesn't look anything like a low-pass filter if you just look at it. We'd have no idea.
Well, it looks like a low-pass filter to me.
Well,
but
yes, you just stare at it.
Sorry. I don't. What can I say?
Change it to another form, and it would look just to
oh, well,
claim, and it would look like
yeah.
Just, you know,
well,
just weird.
As to IR filters and so on, like I said, I really don't like IR filters. I'm not in that proprietorship, so I'm not really going to talk about appetizing filters too much. But I can show you the general idea of how they work.
Appetizing.
So what I'm going to do is I'm generating a short filter. And then I'm going to play with the roots of the filter. Now, this means when I move, if I FIR filters have exactly, have for every pair of zeros that's inside the unit circle, they have an identical pair of zeros outside the unit circle. This is how they get constant delay. So if I take the ones outside the unit circle, move it inside the unit circle, I do not basically take one over the root. I am not going to change the frequency response at all, but I'm going to change the phase response substantially. So what you do here is that one's, if you look here, you see here three different, you notice the frequency responses are identical, the phase responses are very different, the impulse responses are very different, but if you look at the amplitude response, they're identical. And I mean, they are mathematically identical. That's not even an approximation. They are absolutely identical. They're, you know, three lines equals. So you can change, for instance, the symmetric filter, which is the black one, to the minimum phase filter if you want to get that phase shift. You know, so it's less phase shift, but it's curved. The black filter is a line, and the red filter, which is maximum phase, which nobody would ever use, but it makes a nice thing to demonstrate. You notice it has a dip. That means that, relatively speaking, the high frequencies get there below the low before the low frequencies. Now, the only way you can design that filter is by doing convolution, because if you tried to do that with poles, that would be an unstable filter, because it means the basis vector of the pole does this. Good luck implementing that.
So the green has no pre-echo? Is that
what? Well, the point is there are people who argue that the green kind of, there's some... Well, it's not quite that simple.
But double blind says they really can't.
Okay, it means you can have two positions. It means that you have two positions for each of the pairs, because you have pairs of the earth. So there's really, you can have three, for this particular field, you can have 3 to the 4th different phase responses for the same frequency response. And people claim that they have optimum ways to pick these particular things. And I'll believe it when I see it. I don't know. I mean, if somebody comes up with a good listening test and can measure the sensitivity of this, that would be great. But you can only measure the sensitivity after you hear it in the first place. And that makes it hard. That makes it hard to design.
Yeah, if it's that hard.
It's really hard. So that is the first half, and we'll take about 20-minute break. It's 1:55, what, 2:15, and Bob has to set up, and I have to stop, and I'll take questions if you have questions. But there's a reason I ask you guys to ask questions the whole time. Okay, so we will, yeah?
Why don't we do a little longer break, since there's something to eat?
If okay, there's something.
Coffee or something, you got to go somewhere else.
Let's go to 2:30 then. Okay, break till 2:30.
Okay.
Hope it's at least entertaining. I think you know most of this.
Thank you.